It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farage. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll find out how a possible change in labor visas for farm workers could affect agriculture here in Wisconsin. First, gas prices in the U.S. have been declining for 34 straight days. The national average is the lowest it's been since May 15th at just under $4.49 a gallon. That's still significantly higher than it was a year ago, but the White House is hoping the decline could start lowering inflation as a result. Meanwhile, some economists are concerned that a slowing of the economy could lead to a recession, but other indicators of a recession, like unemployment and consumer spending, remain healthy. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing at the gas pumps in your area? Have you seen prices come down steadily? Are you worried about these still high prices of gas? How has it affected you? How much you drive? How much of the budget how much of a budget bite it has put on you? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thought on gas prices, your questions about the wider economy. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Menzie Chin is back with us, professor of public affairs and economics at the Robert M. La Follette School of Public Affairs at UW-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Pleasure to be back here again.
Let's start with gas prices and oil prices, I guess, part of the equation there. Not plummeting, certainly, but declining steadily since that peak last month. What do you see driving those prices back down a little bit?
Okay, so well, gasoline prices through the week ending about July 11th, down about 7% from their peak in late June. So what does that mean? Well, gasoline's about 3.8% of what's in the consumer price index basket. So you have a big change on something that's got a relatively small weight. It can still move around the overall inflation rate. So that's going to shave off about maybe a quarter percentage point on what was like 1.3% increase over the last month. So it's a substantial impact on the direction. And then the big question is whether the big driver of gasoline prices, which is oil prices, are going to continue to fall.
Something I always wonder about with gas prices and inflation, I don't know, maybe it's a stupid question, I don't know. Like, we pay more at the pump directly, but also, you know, diesel prices have been really high. And I imagine that drives up the cost of things that get carried around in trucks, food, furniture, you name it. Is there that kind of secondary effect on inflation when gas prices are up, that transportation cost?
Exactly. It's all over the place. That's an excellent point. You know, so the 3.8% is just the direct cost to consumer basket as measured by the Bureau of Labor Statistics. And if you think about it, well, everything relies upon energy to a certain extent. So gasoline prices for just everybody's living costs, which then feed into wages, but more directly also, all the derivatives of oil that are used for both heating and for driving and logistics and transportation, they too will be pushed up when oil prices go up. And so when oil prices go down, you know, the reverse happens. And so those are other effects that aren't usually mentioned as primary importance, because you have to sort of figure out and trace out exactly how much does, you know, the price of something shipped by Amazon is going to be impacted, for instance, by you know, diesel costs.
Now, one funky thing about oil prices, of course, is they're really volatile. You know, early in the pandemic, one kind of oil was negative money in cost, in effect. Now it's gone up. Things like a Russian invasion of Ukraine can affect oil prices. Things in the Middle East, hurricanes knocking out refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. Yeah. It's hard to predict what's going to happen next, right?
Exactly. And if you think about all the complaints about how we mispredicted inflation, well, I think you have to take into account the fact, you know, several things. First, we came up from very low prices, negative in some sense for futures, you know, prices on what are called derivatives markets, but, you know, essentially negative prices, zero prices for oil at some point. Then you had the reopening of the economy. And then, you know, on top of that, you had some unexpected events, including, for instance, the Russian invasion. So when you talk about, well, why were the experts so wrong? Part of it, not all of it, but part of it was, you know, you make your predictions conditioned on, like, do you expect the Russians to invade further the Ukraine? yes, no, hedge your bets, maybe 10% yes, 90% no. And as it turned out, we were wrong in that assessment. And that's a big part. If you look at the what's happening to inflation month by month, you can see that headline inflation, that is what includes energy and food costs, they're at highs for years and years and years on a month-to-month basis. But if you strip out energy and food, we're actually down. That is, core inflation month-on-month is down relative to what it was, let's say, roughly a year ago. So you're exactly right. Energy prices are extremely volatile. That makes the overall inflation rate a little bit harder to predict, especially when you have events that are big and discrete and impact strongly oil supply. And then, of course, you're right, refineries are sort of this intermediate link between oil prices and gasoline prices. Mm-hmm. If you have an outage, which is much more likely these days, in a situation having an impact because we've had declining refinery capacity, or at least it's not been growing quickly over the years, then you're much more susceptible to these additional shocks along the way, along the pipeline, you might say.
Talking to Menzi Chen, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, doing an economic checkup, gas prices, oil prices, inflation, risk of recession. You can call in with your thoughts, your experiences. How is inflation affecting you? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Denny is with us in Waupaca. Hi, Denny.
Hi. I think there's three things going on. COVID disrupted supply chains that are still not up to speed. President Trump put 1.8 trillion in people's hands. President Biden put 1.9 trillion. And there's $2.5 trillion in corporate savings right now. So you've got a massive amount of money competing for fewer and fewer goods and services, certainly causing some inflation. But the other part of it's just flat gouging. There's a substantial amount of gouging going on in energy and other areas right now. That's my comment.
Denny, thanks. You gave us a half hour worth of material there. Menzi, let's start with his last point, the idea that there's price gouging going on. Denny says, especially in the oil and gas industry. Is that it, or is this just supply and demand?
Well, it depends a lot on your definition of gouging. What's true is if you've got sort of a lot of demand and for something, and people are not very sensitive to the price changes to alter their use of that item, then the suppliers got all the leverage. And so to the extent that the suppliers have the leverage, yeah, you could think of that as gouging. I mean, for economists, we would say that they're exploiting sort of the monopoly power. So, yes, the margins for energy producers are probably increasing a lot. Now, the thing is, that should explain sort of the short-term increase in prices. But you can't have gouging going on. The increase in gouging amount can increase forever so that it forever pushes up the rate of increase of prices. So I could say I'd be in full agreement that, what some people might call gouging is raising the price level faster. But if you think about inflation, which is sort of this trend increase in prices over time, it is in some sense, energy prices and supply and demand. I'm not saying gouging isn't part of the story about prices are so high. It can't explain the sort of continued acceleration of energy prices. And for that, I think you have to look at the collision of resurgent demand against supply constraints, partly because some supply has gone offline, but partly because the OPEC producers have been pretty disciplined about not increasing supply as much as they might have in previous instances.
And Denny also raised something that people talk about a fair amount, Menzi, the idea that, okay, we had so much COVID relief money pumped into the economy. Denny says under the Trump administration, under the Biden administration, that, when the government puts that much money in people's hands and maybe there's limited supply, that in and of itself is going to be a factor in inflation. How big a factor do you see it?
Okay, well, in point of fact, I agree to a certain extent. In fact, I'd say that's more than $1.8 trillion in the previous administration. If you just sum up the many packages that were passed, a small one, then the CARES package, then another one at the end of President Trump's term. And then you had the package passed by the American Rescue Plan under the Biden administration. So that's a lot of stimulus. The latest study I saw was roughly, if I look at overall inflation, maybe half is due to supply issues, including, for instance, oil, maybe a third to demand, and maybe, you know, the rest is you couldn't distinguish exactly where it was coming from. So I think it's fair to say you could apportion a lot of blame to, you know, to excess of demand. Now, it's a little bit hard to say that that's the cause right now, because in point of fact, we had this big burst of spending, and now the level of spending is decreasing, so that you're actually kind of exerting a drag on the economy by shrinking the amount of spending. So I wouldn't say that the demand side is contributing a lot to the inflation we're seeing now. And once again, I come back, you know, the core inflation, you know, stripping out energy and food, that's coming down on a month-to-month basis. But the one that's the headline that we all pay attention to that includes energy, well, that's zipping around up and down a lot in recent months. And a lot of that is because of oil. So we tend to, you know, you get different stories and different culprits looking depending upon which of the price indices you're looking at.
Denny, thanks for the call. We're talking to UW-Madison economics professor Menzi Chin, looking at gas prices, inflation, and concerns over a possible recession. And you can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your experiences. How are gas prices and inflation affecting your life? Are they changing your decisions about how, when, and where to spend money? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at inflation, gas prices, and the risk of a recession in the U.S. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Menzi, before we go back to our callers, I want to give a listen to White House Chief Economist Jared Bernstein, talking about the risk of a recession. This was on Monday.
Based on consumer spending, based on payroll employment, based on where the unemployment rate is, I think we can confidently say that these numbers that we're posting are very much inconsistent with a recessionary call given where we are right now. I think that is the most accurate way to assess the answer to that question.
So not so worried about the risk of a recession, he sounds there. What are you looking at, Menzi, when it comes to the possibility of a recession?
Well, I think there's two distinctions or a single distinction to make about this probability of recession. The first one is the immediate, you know, right now and immediately in the near future. And there, you know, what data we have, I mean, most of the data we have refers to either June or May, indicates that as of June or May, we weren't likely to have been in a recession. Now, that's a little squishy because, you know, the official arbiter of the what's a recession is the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a think tank. There's a particular committee that is charged with making that determination. And it usually does it months, if not years, after the fact. You know, what we can say is with the data we have now, it would seem to be very unlikely that we're in a recession now. And the key thing to look at is things like employment and personal income taking out transfers, and we're rising through June. So, you know, at least May through June. And so those indicators are indicating or suggesting that the economy is still growing. Now, I think what people are worried about, most economists, are that we have relatively high inflation, and the question is whether the Fed is going to step on the brakes so much that by raising interest rates, the Fed funds rate, so much so quickly that it topples the economy into a recession. And by the time you're in a recession, it's too late to sort of pull your foot off the brake. I think most people are thinking that if there's a recession, it'll be sometime in the middle to late part of next year. So we tend to look at various indicators that, you know, are forward looking, like interest rates and long term interest rates. And they seem to suggest that, you know, there's a high likelihood, you know, 50% or more, that in the latter half of 2023, we'll go into recession if the historical relationships hold.
Let's go back to our callers now. Tom is with us in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I just have a comment. I think it's interesting that we talk about the concerns of the cost of energy, either for fuel, for moving cars, or for food production. And yet, the other big issue in the news cycle is droughts in Western United States and Africa, heat wave in Europe and Great Britain. It's like we're concerned about the fuel on one hand, and then the global warming that's happening significantly because of fuel use on the other, but we never integrate the two.
Tom, thanks for the call. Well, gave me an easy opportunity to promo. We'll talk about extreme heat and climate change tomorrow on the show, Tom. But Menzie, I think sometimes it's easy to look at climate change as an externality, I think economists call it, to the oil and fuel industry, but it does affect the economy too.
Yes. I mean, so I would say that the caller is exactly right. We, you know, if, yeah, as an economist speaking about how we should address externalities, you know that their fossil fuel consumption or use has a benefit to the private user, but then all these costs of pollution and global climate change spill over and impinge upon everybody, not just our next door neighbor, but all over the world. And so the economist solution is to internalize the externalities, that is, make people behave as if they took into account those costs, and that is to put a tax or to regulate somehow indirectly through cap and trade to make it such that we behave in a way that we take into account those costs. Now, those things go by the wayside in terms of people's interest when gasoline prices spike up. That's the unfortunate aspect of politics. But in principle, I would say you don't want to react crazily in the moment where you've got high prices. You should probably want to be on some sort of long-term path where you're having the price of fossil fuels reflect these costs. And that would mean, you know, less reliance upon fossil fuels at exactly these times that you might have these spikes. You might not ever be able to get rid of these spikes, but at least you wouldn't be so reliant upon those energy sources. And you wouldn't have this impulse to, let's say, give a tax holiday on gasoline at such times. So I don't know if that's an answer to the question, but, you know, surely there's a better way of addressing these two concerns than sort of reacting in a sort of unfocused manner.
Tom, thanks for that call. Mike joins us next in Madison. Mike, hello.
Hi. Yes, I wanted to just comment on something earlier. Yeah, I agree that we need to allow the refineries to be built in this country. We have to have the EPA and regulatory agencies free up that ability in order for us to be able to lower our prices of fuel. Going back on what the previous caller just said, only about 5% of a barrel of oil is asphalt cement for our roads. So even if we're all driving electric vehicles, we're still going to have to find something to do with the other 95% of a barrel of oil in order to pave our roadways. And then the third thing is China's going nuclear. They've got 100 new nuclear plants planned in the next 25, 30 years. They're building their own sun. And if we don't start to free up the ability for nuclear power plant development in this country, our economy is going to be severely depressed because we won't be able to compete not only on a labor pricing formula, but also on the energy formula. They're going to have such cheap energy in comparison.
Mike, I got you. We don't have too much time left. Menzie, his first and third points there allow more refinery building, which can be a bottleneck, turning oil into gasoline, and more nuclear development, two ways Mike says we can help cut energy costs.
Well, I mean, probably we want more refinery investment or capacity investment just to remove bottlenecks. But the overall question is whether you want to encourage more fossil fuel use. And I think the answer is, given the externalities which we're living through, even as we speak with record temperatures around the world, I think you have to say that you want to decrease consumption of fossil fuels. That's my judgment based upon values, but I think an economist would typically agree with that. Now, so the other issue about energy costs and so forth, well, maybe nuclear would be better. I think you have to look at the relative costs. And one of the things that people don't remark upon is that the cost of renewables is dropping over time, especially if you think about taking into account the externalities. You know, renewables, you know, not all of them are pollution-free, but they're mostly pollution-free. What's happening is that, you know, you have the cost of photovoltaics, getting solar power dropping. You have development of more wind power. In Texas, for instance, like a quarter of wind of total generation is wind power, if not more. And the storage technology is improving over time so that the costs are going down there. So I think there's a whole panoply of things besides just between going fossil, nuclear, and renewables. You know, what you'll want to do is to look at the relative cost of these things. In the United States, nuclear has been relatively expensive to develop for a variety of reasons in any case. So it's not just enough to say, well, we want more nuclear. You don't have the right private incentives necessarily to go to nuclear. And it's not clear that you really want to go all the way to nuclear in any case, given costs.
Mike, thanks for that call. Menzie, big picture in our last half minute, what economic news are you watching for next?
Well, I think two observations. One is that while the short-term inflation rates are high and the short-term expectations are for high inflation rates, people, if I just ask ordinary people as well as economists, they view the inflation rate that we'll see in the next year as substantially lower, something closer to 3% over a 12-month basis. So in that sense, people don't expect inflation to be at the rates that they are now. And then looking even further out, expectations of inflation are much closer to 2 to 3%, so what we would call anchored. So the fear of getting the runaway inflation that we got in the 70s, remember, we still haven't hit the inflation rate that we got in 1980, for instance, that fear is somewhat mitigated. So I have hope there. The other thing is, I'd say don't overreact. I think that's a big question. Whether the Fed raises interest rates too much, and that who knows ahead of time, that's the thing that you might worry about toppling us and the rest of the world economy into recession.
Menzie, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Menzie Chin from UW-Madison's La Follette School of Public Affairs, looking at the latest economic news, including gas prices and inflation. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, a new book tells the story of lesser-known figures in American labor history and the impact they had on modern workplaces. We'll meet the author of the book, Fight Like Hell. Now, an immigration bill that sponsors say could lower food costs is in negotiation in the U.S. Senate. It would allow some migrant workers in the agricultural sector to work year-round in the U.S. instead of temporary seasonal work. The bill, known as the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, would directly impact farmers and migrants using the H-2A Temporary Agricultural Program. The bill passed in the House. Supporters are working to find at least 60 votes in the Senate. Details still being worked out there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you a farmer hiring workers through H-2A, or would you like to be if the rules change? Do you think it is a good program? Do you want to see this act passed? In general, what questions do you have about the laws regarding immigrant workers in agriculture in Wisconsin and around the country? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel Costa is the Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. Daniel, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
And Philip Martin is a professor emeritus in agricultural and resource economics at the University of California, Davis. He's a UW alum. Philip, welcome back to Wisconsin.
Thank you. It's good to be back.
Can you spell out the basics? Again, the details are still being worked out in the Senate, but what do you see as the key elements of this Farm Workforce Modernization Act?
Well, the Farm Workforce Modernization Act is essentially a redo of the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. So back in 1986, when maybe 10 to 15% of U.S. farm workers were unauthorized, there was a big debate in Congress over what to do about unauthorized immigrants. And what IRCA did in 1986 was legalize current unauthorized farm workers and make it easier for farmers to hire legal guest workers under a program known as the H-2A program. And the theory was that by legalizing currently unauthorized workers, those workers could come out of the shadows, request and obtain higher wages and better benefits. And if farmers did not offer those higher wages and benefits, the workers would leave for non-farm jobs. They would have to build housing in order to employ H-2A workers. So the basic idea behind the Farm Workforce Modernization Act is exactly the same as what was tried in 1986. Legalize currently unauthorized workers and make it easier to hire legal replacement workers. The ultimate goal is to give agriculture a legal workforce as opposed to the current situation in which about half of the crop workers are not authorized to work in the U.S.
And Daniel, before we turn to some of the changes, the specific changes, what have labor conditions been like for workers, not the unauthorized ones now, but the ones currently under the H-2A program?
Sure. Well, this has been a very fast growing workforce. The program, the size of the number of workers coming in has tripled in about the past decade, more than tripled. And there have been just really many, many cases of abuse, unfortunately. Advocates have pointed them out. There's been news reports. There's been government audit reports about how many abuses these workers face, about the type of exploitation that happens. And it's really the reason that it happens is because of the way the program is structured. The program ties workers to one single employer. And so the employer has a lot of control over them. They really have control over their ability to remain in the United States. And so you see cases of trafficking. Phil and I have done research on the investigations, the wage and hour investigations. There's millions of dollars stolen from H-2A workers over the years. And so it is really a problematic visa program. And the reforms that worker advocates have been pushing for are really so that these workers would have more rights and not face issues like wage theft and trafficking.
Now, Phil, as I understand the current state of the program, it's really more geared to seasonal farm work, the peach harvest in Georgia, say, or something like that. Dairy farming in Wisconsin is, its season is all year. Does that make it hard for, say, dairy farmers to use this program as it's currently constituted?
Yeah, the theory behind the program, when it was set up first in 1952, is that if you're hiring workers to fill year-round jobs, you should be able to find workers within the United States. So the program is limited to seasonal work, and normally that's defined as a job lasting 10 months or less. The Farm Workforce Modernization Act would begin to change that by allowing up to 20,000 H-2A workers a year to work in year-round jobs. With that, of course, comes more complications. What do you do about the families of workers? H-2A workers are in the U.S. on average now about 6 months a year. So if we're going to have workers working year-round, and under the proposal they could stay up to 3 years, would farmers have to provide housing for families as opposed to what they now are required to provide, which is typically dorm rooms, where we'll have 4 or 8 workers to a room in bunk beds. So, yes, the proposed reform opens up more farm jobs to H-2A workers and raises other questions in the process of doing that.
We were talking about possible changes in immigrant visas for farm labor. Currently, negotiations going on in the U.S. Senate. With us, Daniel Costa from the Economic Policy Institute, Philip Martin from the University of California, Davis. You could join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Daniel, one sticking point, as I understand it, in the Senate right now, the bill that passed in the House would allow workers receiving these H-2A visas, if their rights were being violated by employers, it would allow them to sue to get enforcement. There's pushback against that from some in the farm lobby, and that's one of the sticking points in the Senate. Can you talk about that part of the bill?
Sure. So the what the bill does is it takes the Migrant and Seasonal Worker Protection Act, which is one of the main laws that protect farm workers, and apply it to H-2A workers. At present, it only applies to U.S. farm workers, and it is one of the key benefits, I think, of the bill is that it would increase protection for workers in this way. I do think that all of the noise that employers are making about it, the complaints about it, are really not, maybe not in good faith, because, I think most employers who hire H-2A workers are already hiring U.S. farm workers as well. Therefore, much of their workforce is already subject to and covered by MISPA, as the law is often known, and so therefore I think it's an important protection. I don't think that it's going to have the type of impact that employers are complaining about, because many of their workers are already covered by this. So I do hope that this is one of those things that it stays in the bill if it moves forward.
Now, Daniel, again, we're in Wisconsin. Do you think, you said 20,000? I think. Year-long visas that could go up to 3 years. That's not a lot when you divide it up around the country. Do you see potentially a state like Wisconsin getting a big chunk of those visas?
Well, it's hard to say. There are about 437,000 year-round agricultural jobs, which would could vie for those 20,000 visas a year. I mean, it would be only 20,000 in the first 3 years, according to the bill, and then there could be adjustments after. So potentially the number could go up, and those visas, because I believe they would last 3 years, and the 20,000, the numbers would add up. So you would end up having a higher number, and probably within a few years, a much higher number. So I do think that it sort of starts off small, kind of almost as a pilot program, but then it has the potential to grow. But you are talking about a lot of year-round jobs and just a small number of visas.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mark is with us in Richland Center. Mark, hi.
Yeah, to speak to that disparity of how many actual people would benefit from this program. When you look at just milking cows in the state of Wisconsin, virtually all of big dairy operations are using workers that are for the most part illegal, and that's a huge amount of the workforce. So the question about the mistreatment of immigrant workers, these people live here year-round. They milk the cows every day, sometimes three times a day, and the question is, the entire industry knows that virtually their entire workforce is illegal. So this program is not really doing much for them, and they do get mistreated. I guarantee you they get mistreated. And virtually everybody in this industry knows that.
Mark, thanks for the call. Philip, what do we know? And I assume this is by its nature hard to measure. What do we know about the extent of the use of undocumented immigrants in U.S. agriculture?
Well, the problem we have is that the U.S. government surveys only people employed in crop agriculture, not in livestock agriculture. And they only employ non-H-2A workers. They only survey non-H-2A workers. And that's a 70 by 70 rule. So 70% of crop workers were born abroad, usually in Mexico, and 70% of them are unauthorized. And if you remember your fractions, 0.7 times 0.7 is 0.49, so half of the crop workers are unauthorized. In dairy, there's roughly 100,000 people employed in the U.S. dairy industry, a little over 9 million cows, 1.7, 1.8 million in California, 1.2 million in Wisconsin. And so, you know, if all of those three-year visas went to dairies, then you would have half of the U.S. dairy workforce under H-2A within 3 years. And as Daniel mentioned, you can adjust it up or down. I think the bigger, you know, the legalization issue is that those currently unauthorized workers could get legal work permits. And once they got legal, so if you did 180 days of farm work in the previous 2 years, you're eligible for a legal work permit that's good for 5 years, over 5.5 years. And you maintain your legal status so long as you do 100 days of farm work a year. And after you do that 100 days for 4 or 8 years, depending how long you've been here, you can become an immigrant and eventually a naturalized U.S. citizen. So just like in 1986, the theory is that you take people who are currently unauthorized, you give them legal status, their employers have to improve wages and working conditions, or those workers might leave and go to non-farm jobs where they have higher wages or better conditions. That was the theory 40 years ago, and that's the argument today. Legalization empowers workers. We'll see. And it did not work that way in the late 1980s and early 1990s because more unauthorized workers came. We'll see if it works that way this time around. But it should be mentioned that efforts to bring about this kind of change have been going on since the mid-1990s. So we passed IRCA in 1986, and there have been efforts to bring about exactly what is being discussed now, at least for the last 20-some-odd years. It used to be called ag jobs. Now it was blue cards for a while. Now it's farm workforce modernization. So I guess I would not hold my breath that it will happen this time. It may happen. But people thought it was going to happen in 2006. They thought it was going to happen in 2013. So I guess in the political climate we're in, it would be difficult to bet money that that the additional votes will be there, that this will get passed, it'll get reconciled with the House and become law.
We're talking to Philip Martin, Professor Emeritus in Agricultural and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis, and Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. We're looking at the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, an immigration-related bill that would allow, among other things, longer-term work visas for some farm workers. You can still join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on what you're hearing about, whether you want this to pass, your questions, your experiences. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about an immigration bill that would change the rules on how long migrant workers could stay employed at agriculture in the U.S. Philip Martin with us from the University of California, Davis. Daniel Costa with the Economic Policy Institute. And you at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Jill is with us in Cross Plains. Jill, hi.
Hi. Thank you for the program today. I have a question for your guests. I'm just wondering how much a migrant worker is paid, you know, versus an American citizen who might do the same job. I mean, obviously, there must be a great deal of savings there that the farming industry is using the migrant workers. I just have no idea how much these folks are paid.
Jill, interesting question. Daniel, do you have thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, under the Fair Labor Standards Act, they're all supposed to at least be paid the minimum wage. But an H-2A worker is paid what's called the adverse effect wage rate, which is set by the Labor Department and which sets it in turn by the USDA survey of field and livestock workers, and it's set out by different regions. And that wage is higher usually than the federal minimum wage. What unauthorized workers earn, it's really hard to say because the surveys out there about farm wages, survey both unauthorized workers and authorized workers. And so I'm not sure. Phil might have some more thoughts about that, but it's kind of hard to actually calculate and get a sense of what the disparity would be.
And Phil, Jill's question gets at kind of a core issue here. As I understand it, farmers have a hard time finding enough American citizens to do this often rigorous, difficult labor.
Well, there's several answers to this question. I mean, the adverse effect wage rate for Wisconsin and Minnesota and Michigan is $15.37 in 2022. So it's well above the minimum wage. The pro and con is this: the $15.37 is the minimum wage that has to be paid, but it also means that employers expect workers to work in order to earn that wage. And Daniel already mentioned the fact that if I come, 93% of the H-2A workers are from Mexico. If I come from Mexico and come to work for a farm for $15.37 an hour, the employer has to provide me with housing. I am there to work, and I will probably work extra hours and weekends if I'm needed. Whereas a local worker, a U.S. worker, including an unauthorized worker who's settled in the U.S., may not necessarily want to work extra hours or weekends or other things. And so you often will hear that the Americans don't want to do this work, and that's why we turn to H-2A workers. And it's true that farm jobs, seasonal farm jobs, tend to be jobs, not careers. Relatively few mothers wake up and say, I hope my child becomes a seasonal farm worker. And so people, even children of farm workers who are educated in the United States, tend not to go into the fields. If you talk to a lot of farm workers, they'll say, this is okay for me. The average hired farm worker in the United States has about 8.5 years of education. And so people will say, this is good for me, given that I went to school in rural Mexico, but I want my children to get more education so they don't come out here. And so seasonal farm work has traditionally been a job that's filled by one generation of people without too many other job options, but their own children tend not to follow them into the field. So you can think of it almost as a treadmill, that as people drift out of farm work after 10 or 15 or 20 years, then there needs to be a new infusion of people. And typically in the United States, that new infusion has come from rural Mexico.
Jill, thanks again for that call. Dan, I wanted to ask about one of the outcomes that sponsors of this bill are hoping for. They're saying this could help decrease food prices. Do you see a chain of events if this bill passes, these visas get altered, that it would affect food prices?
That's really hard to say. I think inflation has also been cited in the context of this discussion. I don't think there's a lot of evidence that labor costs are leading to inflation and rising prices. But, one thing that the bill would do is it would stabilize labor costs for farmers. And that's one of the main reasons they want it, because it freezes the AWOR wage for H-2A workers for a year, and then it sets up a new methodology, and then some of the workers will end up getting lower wages, or their wages just won't rise as fast as they otherwise normally would if this law didn't pass. And so it will stabilize labor costs. I don't know that we have a lot of evidence that it's going to do much on food prices.
And just our last, just over a minute, Philip, I know you're looking ahead. What do you see farming looking like over the next few years, short and medium term?
Well, the story of agriculture has been fewer and larger farms, squeezing out the middle. So the U.S. has 2 million farms. The largest 100,000, 150,000 produce 3/4 of all farm output. 3/4 of farmers are hobby and retirement operations. They lose money farming year after year. And the story in agriculture has always been, if you're in the middle, if you're too big to depend on a non-farm job or retirement or something, but not big enough to get economies of scale, you're in trouble. And that I expect to see more hired workers on fewer and larger farms. And the big question we're asking is, who will those farm workers be? Will they be the unauthorized workers today, legal guest workers tomorrow, U.S. citizens? It's, you know, at this point, we would expect more of the same, which is a mixture of all three.
Thanks to both of our guests. We've been talking to Philip Martin, Professor Emeritus in Agriculture and Resource Economics at the University of California, Davis, and Daniel Costa, Director of Immigration Law and Policy Research at the Economic Policy Institute. They joined us for a look at the Farm Workforce Modernization Act, a version passed the House. Now it's in the Senate. Negotiations going on. We'll see what happens. It deals with migrant farm workers and the way their visas work. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, explore the Great Lakes. A Midwest travel expert joins the show with great ideas for weekend getaways and more in the Great Lakes region. And, of course, you can join in and share your favorites. Do you have a favorite Great Lakes getaway? Email now, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. I cooked something new this weekend, new for me. I mean, lots of people have eaten it before. I bought a bunch of radishes at a farmer's market, and it came with the greens on. Now, usually when that happens, I just compost the greens, even though I know they're supposed to be edible. So this time I figure I'm going to cook them. So I did a dish with radish greens and chickpeas and stuff. Came out pretty good. I learned two lessons I can share with anyone else who wants to give a radish greens a try for the first time while they're in season. One, the leaves cook down like spinach. Like at the beginning, it looks like you're not going to fit it all in the pan. After a few minutes of sauteing, they're just like these subatomic particles. And two, everybody on the internet said take off the thicker parts of the stems because they're tough. They stay tough even when you cook them. They were not kidding. I missed a few of the stems when I was eating it. I hit one of those. It was like the consistency of a really thin shoelace. So not too appetizing there. Other than that, I highly recommend radish greens. Food experimentation news that you can use. This is Central Time.